Welcome to Innovation and Leadership. I'm Jess Larson. On this episode, we've got Steve Munford, CEO of Trulio. Steve, thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Jess. Happy to be here.
So the last funding numbers I saw, I think you guys had raised $394 million at a $1.75 billion valuation. Does that sound close?
Yep. You got your numbers, yep.
And then sounds like you guys have grown a bit since then. That's an old valuation.
Well, I mean, it was a 2021 valuation, but yeah, we have grown. We did an acquisition, so a bit inorganic, but also we're just seeing a huge demand for what we do.
Yeah. So for people who don't understand why verification matters so much these days, can you explain what the business does and who your typical clients are?
Sure. So we're digital identity verification. Now, the easiest way to think about that is that if you were opening a bank account 10 years ago, you'd go into your local bank, you'd show two pieces of ID, and they would establish you are who you are. They established a certain layer of trust, and then you'd open your bank account. Now, you fast forward to as everything goes digital, that's goods and services. How do you do that digitally? And secondly, as companies are increasingly global, large companies, how do you do it on a global scale? Like identify someone in the US, fairly straightforward. Do an identity check on someone that is in sub-Saharan Africa or Europe or Asia is really, really hard. So that's what we do. We help large companies do identity verification to establish trust or satisfy a regulatory requirement, all digitally, real time. And we do it in a very safe and compliant way. So our customers are, if you've been selling anything on a two-sided marketplace or offering a service, so if you think about people like on eBay or Etsy or any of those kind of marketplaces, you really have to have trust in who those sellers are. So we're all part of that equation. If you signed up for an online trading account or likely buying and selling crypto, we will have been the identity verification step in that process. Now, I would never know, Jess, if you have come through a process, because we don't actually have that visibility, but you likely to use their services.
And giving people a sense of scale of like how many transactions or how many customers around the world, can you give people a sense of that?
Sure. One of the things that we really aim to do is provide a platform that we can, one day, 8 billion people will be able to be identity used on our platform. Today, we can reach about 5 billion people. We operate in about 195 countries. We're doing close to 100 million different verifications every year. We also do it for businesses. So businesses in 195 countries. So pretty big scale.
Yeah, no kidding. I would say 5 billion different individuals is decent scale. I mean, you guys can work on it.
I know, but the last 3 billion, I mean, the long tail, it's a long tail problem. And any of this is on business size, understanding who Microsoft is, it's easy. Understanding who, one of your companies maybe is harder. So it's, and same with people.
Yeah, no kidding. So in a world like this, you know, there's some few people that have operated in this space. What are the drivers of growth? I mean, you've got such reach so far, you're a dominant player. How do you think about it from here?
Yeah, so one thing about identity verification, it's a problem that never will be fully solved. I spent 25 years in cybersecurity, and it was fascinating because it was always changing for a variety of reasons. So identity verification is similar, and whether it's the establishment of new regulations, whether it is reaching that last 3 billion people, whether it is the ways that bad actors will go about trying to steal identity verifications or pretend they're someone else, it's an always changing problem. So really key for us is we work with some of the top brands across the verticals that we serve. And our growth is, on one hand, alongside them as they grow and get more customers and go globally, that really accelerates our growth. But it's also understanding the next piece of value that they want us to do, or what more can we help them be better at it, right? Because there's this real differentiation, and you would see it. If you want to sign up for a new service or platform, the ease of which you can do it dictates, how many platforms you'll sign up or what platform you'll choose. But similarly for the company, if they make it too easy and don't apply the right level of scrutiny on the customers, they can allow for a lot of bad actors to get on that platform. which is, as you can imagine, an increasing problem.
Yeah, no kidding. So when you think about these additional problems that your customers say, hey, I think you're the right people to help us with that, can you give us some examples?
Sure. It could be a new market. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of companies go into Africa these days. And so this, the way that you can do identity verification in Nigeria or Kenya or South Africa, they're all different, right? So we have to do a lot of work to figure out what information is available, how do you get access to it, what rights to be used. So we really are partnering with our customers as they think of that net new country they're going into. Secondly, I mean, today that whole onboarding process is generally a collection of siloed steps, and we're increasingly helping customers bring those together under one platform and allow them to share information along the way, get to better decisioning, lower the cost, lower the friction. So it's a combination of doing more for our customers. It's a combination of helping them go more to new markets. And lastly, there's always that next new platform or next customer that we want to have.
Yeah, you know, you sound like another Canadian I had on the show this week. The CEO over at 1Password. You know, I was saying like, okay, you got $6.8 billion valuation. Where do you go from here? And he's like, more problems, more territories. You know, yeah. Like that's kind of the basics there, and talked about some similar themes. So maybe he needs you to help verify the users who are going to sign up for 1Password in all these places.
Well, it's interesting. I know 1Password. It's a great company. And essentially, we're the step before that, right? So 1Password will re-authenticate you, if you will, or re-verify you once they know who you are. We help the companies know who that is. I don't know if you find this a common theme if you talk to Canadians, that we're generally a bit understated compared to maybe some of the folks down south of the border. But I got this analogy once. I said, is that I think if Canadians were marketing sushi, they'd call it cold dead fish on rice.
Yeah. Less likely to blow our own horns. My wife's an American, grew up in the States, and I'm an American born abroad because my dad's from the States, even though I've been born and raised in Alberta. And my wife, her big observation of us spending years in Calgary and Southern Alberta was that we have a higher priority on comedy. She's like, really? Yep. She thinks that Americans have a higher priority on achievement. And like, there's as a society, you know, like obviously we've got amazing entrepreneurs out of Canada, right? But like as a society, Americans are a little more worried about achievement and you know, winning at their sports and winning at this and this kind of stuff. And Canadians are a little more worried about having a good time. And like, just like the percentage of conversations that include laughter in Canada is significantly higher than US. And so as I started to notice it, because I'd grown up, you know, I had American cousins, Canadian cousins. And like, once she started pointing it out, I was like, yeah, it's true. Canadians have a good time.
Yeah, that's interesting. I spent 9 years in the UK, and I would say they spend a lot of time trying not to take themselves too seriously. They're also good at the humor thing as well. So,
yeah, totally. What other advantages do you think you've had being from Canada with the business?
What I found in my career is, everyone's different, but I think by and large, because Canada is not the dominant market, is that when you run a Canadian company, you really are focused on expansion globally, because you have to be, right? So the US is obviously the first one. But then beyond that, it just becomes natural next steps, because you can't rely on your domestic market. In fact, I find the Canadian market incredibly difficult to sell into. So I think that's one advantage. I think, you know, certainly when I lived in the UK, I think the Canadians culturally was, what do they say, America and Britain had a baby and threw it in the snow, that'd be Canada. I think we can kind of bridge the cultural gap between the Brits and the US, and certainly the Europeans in the US. And I think those ingredients are great to build a global economy.
Yeah, no kidding. Will, why don't you tell us a couple of career highlights before coming here?
Sure. I So I guess I was at this company back in 99 called ActiveState. We were building open source tools where it was in the world that Red Hat was making Linux, putting Linux on the map. We thought we could do the same thing with programming languages. And then the dot-com crisis hit, and we had to do a pivot. And that pivot, we actually started making anti-spam fraud software. Long story why, but we did. And that eventually we sold to Sophos, and it was a great outcome for investors. And then I was asked to come over and run the combined company. And that was just a tremendous experience just going to the UK. I must say, Twilio is probably the most fascinating company I've run. This whole notion of how do you do digital identity for 8 billion people in the world is a hard problem. It attracts a phenomenal, passionate of people because you're kind of doing good, right? You're building this level playing field for global commerce. And I could talk about that a lot, but you've got this really mission-driven company, but you have this service that's incredibly needed, and doing that through COVID, through the 21 craziness, and then kind of keeping that keeping everything together through 23 and 24, you know, it's just been interesting, hard, very different than anything else I've done.
Sure. When you think about the level that the business has gotten to, can you share with us a $1.75 billion success secret, you know, from your observations from inside compared to just the business theories out there?
Sure. I think valuations is a product of someone believing that you've got the best product in an important market, in a growth market. And so I would say certainly the tech companies I've run, just never underestimate understanding product market fit and just having the best product and being relentlessly focused on a set of customers that see value from it. And then that customer success, making your customers successful, is just so powerful. So, you know, a great product, good team, focus on the customers and making them successful, and good things will happen. So I really do hate the term unicorns or valuations as a benchmark for success of a company. I think for us, I talked about we've never lost a large customer. Actually FTX was one, but that was a hard one to avoid. But I think the strength of the offering and the value we bring to our customers is what makes great companies. And then the valuation follows.
Yeah. Yeah, it's absolutely a lagging indicator, not a leading indicator, right?
I don't know if you found out, like, you've been doing this for a while, but I found a period of time, like in 21, it was just like, you could probably Google and you'd see this unicorn everywhere. Like, where did that word go? Because there were so many fake unicorns because it was based on you know, just a bunch of unrealistic expectations and not based on great products in good markets.
I'm a huge fan of Howard Marks from Oaktree, you know, and, you know, one of the only humans on earth to have Warren Buffett endorse his book, right? And, you know, he talks about, like, big sin in the market of too much money chasing too few deals. And people make silly choices, right? And sometimes some of those valuations were the silly choices, right?
Well, and we when we raised money, we valuation was certainly important, but that was not the deciding factor of who we chose to work with. We partnered with TCB. They've been in growth equity for quite a long time. I've known them for a long time, but they're people that have partnered with companies and gone through different cycles and are thoughtful. There was like kids in crash helmets just throwing around money at crazy valuations that thought it was some kind of hedge fund bet. And it just to have a place in every interesting company in the market as a strategy. That's not such a good partner to have when things are, you really need a thoughtful partner when things get tough or you really have hard strategic choices to make.
Yeah. You know, I'm with you on the valuation, especially private, you know what I mean?
When
not so market-based. There is one aspect of it though, like there is this separation factor of like, are you running a $10 million business or a $1 billion business? You know, like, even though it's so imprecise, it it does have a range on it.
That, yeah.
Right. That's like, it speaks to like the scale that somebody's trying for, right? Kind of a thing. And so, well, actually, I want to dig into this. One of my favorite things to ask, you know, billion-dollar plus CEOs is how they would define product market fit. So I'm glad you brought this up. How would you define it?
Right. I always say it is when you have evidence that your customer is using your product in anger. And what, why I say that is you can produce products with a lot of functionality and people will buy it for all sorts of reasons. And people may buy it and never use it, or they don't, they use a fraction of what you're spending your R&D efforts on. Or they could, everyone could use it for all different reasons. And so there's a lot of false positives on product market fit. And so what we really look for is the level of engagement we have with the customers and the evidence that they're using all the functionality of the product and that it's performing a real strategic important part of their business. And so that's a lot of rigor. And I think as a CEO, you owning that, and you own being the critical person in the room, not critical as in you're critical of your product, but just having a critical mindset to look for the evidence of it. And I find it is often when I've gone involved with the companies, there is some kind of product market fit. So I can't take credit for that because I'm more of a person that helps the company grow. But I would say when people start to see their second and third product, they often are they miss the signals because they're too confident. Because they had one good product, that the second one will be as good. And there's a lot of false positives in that stage of a company's growth. But I do think it is the rigor and the leadership team, the CEO, to really understand why people use your product and what they like about it, you know, everything you can imagine.
Yeah. So thinking about this second or third product that maybe was being launched when you were growing the business, can you tell us a story of one that was like, it wasn't quite there, and then this helped to get over the hump?
Yeah. So we're all, you know, we're origins of all verifying individuals digitally. The next product that we got into was businesses, right? And just like people need to verify, businesses need to be verified, especially in a gig economy or this just growing, you know, this growing category of sole proprietors or small businesses. And so we went about solving it a very the same way, right? Let's get information on businesses. Let's allow people to type in certain pieces of information, and we can say, yeah, that business exists. And that has value, some value to some companies. It's not full value, right? So we had people using us, and we were saying, hey, we're helping people do business verification, but really much of what we are doing is just helping them weed out what is obviously not a business. So you know, if the business doesn't exist, then it's not a business. But we really weren't helping them go through and understand the UBOs or the people of control of the business. What they need to know is the person maybe opening a business account really working for that business, or are they an imposter opening up a fake business? So we got a lot of early signals from our existing customers that we got a lot of sales and we're delivering some value, but not the real hard part of the value and not what our customers really need to do to be thorough about the problem. And that really just, we got to know that better through engaging with our customers, understand the full process, really understand the value we deliver today, but ultimately the value they want to see. And so that was I call that a 4-year journey. But last year it just took hold, right? Just a combination of what the market needed and our relentless focus on improving the product. It was a big part of our growth last year.
So digging into that a little bit more, when you think about listening with humility, instead of hearing, oh, you know, look at our sales, people must love us, but like listening for disconfirming evidence, listening for what we haven't nailed yet, any advice to whether it's founders or CEOs listening today or investment fund managers who are advising their CEOs?
I think those are great words. I actually haven't heard those words. I like that. Listening with humility. Was that it? I would say a couple of things. One is, you know, make sure that you've got the data, the metrics that are signals of success or signals of failures. I would say, secondly, you know, understand the parts of the company that really know what the customer does with your product, right? So I would say that's a cross between sales engineers and the implement anyone in tech support or implementation, if those functions exist. You know, salespeople are wonderful, but they're there to deliver promises and getting commitments. They're not evidence of the product really is doing what it says it's going to do. So sales engineers, implementation, tech support, I find wonderful people. And then secondly, really, really spending time at meeting with your customers and getting the rigor, like a QBR, or again, I'm probably talking about a lens through selling to large customers where you have the luxury of kind of one-on-one interactions.
And what does QBR stand for?
Oh, sorry, quarterly business reviews, right? We do a data science exercise, talking about the performance enhancements and that kind of stuff. But by delivering value in that process, we really get the right to ask them about, you know, what else we could be doing, what they don't like. And those are incredibly valuable because you're not, you lose the filter, right? You get, and you can look for patterns.
And what's an example of a piece of value you're bringing them at that quarterly review?
So we will look at their traffic and we will say, first of all, we have the ability to kind of try different scenarios, get us that traffic without affecting their traffic to improve performance, getting better match rates, lowering the friction. So we can come to them with new ideas. Secondly, we have insights because we're working with the leaders across a whole host of industries. We can share not specifics, but general best practices that we're seeing. We can talk about, and it's also listening to them about what challenges, what new markets, you know, the other things we talked about. But yeah, I would say it's a data insights. It's really, I think that's where increasingly customers are looking for you. So tell me what best practices, tell me how you think I can improve my performance. You're the experts. Help me get more value.
Along those lines, thinking about data, what advice would you have for people to maybe up their proficiency at being able to decipher the real story the data is telling instead of just the obvious story or the story we wish it was telling?
Yeah.
What kind of thoughts about, like, you made some comment earlier and I wish I could remember it, about, like, you know, your data on what's not working or something. I can't remember what you call that.
I think it's looking at, can you put things in your product that are demonstrably evidence that it's working, right? So where, you know, we have a platform, right? We watch where customers are going on that platform and we try to aggregate what they're actually using of all the different functionality we use. We certainly benchmark our data to ensure that, you know, we're constantly improving on everything that matters, right? So it could be response time, it could be acceptance rates, all these metrics that really matter to our customers. And then you can go into things like win-loss ratios, demo to close, like the evidence that early on we're good at telling that story. So there's, probably could go on for a while.
Yeah. No, I love it. I think, you know, the things we hear most back from listeners are about specifics and about stories.
Yeah, okay.
So that's what I love. Because I think what it is like, in an organization, there's such common language. And so when somebody says a more general adjective about something or a label for something, like add value, right?
Yeah.
Across industries, that means so many things. Across companies within the same industry, that means different things. And so when you get down to this, you know, like, here's an example. We're actually bringing them data and we're saying, hey, by the way, when other people are doing this, they're getting more customers because they're doing that. You might want to consider it. Like, that is like, oh, wow, I wouldn't have had that data if my vendor hadn't brought it to me. That's actually a great idea. Let's run some experiments. Like, that is doing, like, that becomes more tangible for me to go home and go, okay, what is the version of that for my industry, for my company, you know?
Yeah. I think one, so here's a story. Like, I every fall and every spring, I'll go on a road trip and visit customers, big customers, small customers. And I tell my go-to-market people, I'm happy to talk to, I don't need to talk to the CEO. I want to talk to the person that is using our product, big customers, small customers. And you develop a series of questions that you try to ask this every customer to try to gauge what we're doing well and what we're not doing well. And if you provide the right environment to do that, you get phenomenal feedback. And last year I went around and one of the common things I heard was, man, you got the nicest API on the market and it's got great documentation, right? So here we are, we talk about all these wonderful things we do, but the API is what the people love, right? The ease of integrating to one API, you can access 195 countries, the eloquence, the performance, everything about it, right? But then you look at your website, you look at your marketing material, you look at what you're training your salespeople on. And we look at our competitors. Are we benchmarking our API? Are we selling the API? Are we training the salespeople? Are we talking about it? Do we know why it's better and what we could do to even make it more better? That is the art of just kind of getting out there and really trying to understand the truth and then bring it back to our organization to try to challenge it to do more.
Yeah, I love that. Because I think it's so easy to congratulate ourselves. Hey guys, we're awesome. Look at the feedback we're getting. And if you don't track yourself, you don't track your competitors, how do you know if somebody's is going to lap you, right? You said this comment, you can get really great feedback if you create the right environment. What are a couple of elements of creating the right environment to get the feedback that you'd like?
Yeah, I think one of the core tenets of our culture, and this has been something that if I'm interviewing people, hiring people, talking to the company, I'll always refer to is, there's two tenets, but this is the most important one, is open communication, open and honest communication. And I think if you start at the company with creating a safe space where people can communicate openly, and when I say that, it's getting definitional, right? So it's not that, yes, we have lots of meetings and tell people about how we're doing as a company, what's happening at the company. That's one way of communication. But the most important is when you conduct a meeting, regardless of who that is in the meeting, you've got to have a culture where people can challenge the CEO. I can ask questions of people that report to me. People can ask questions of each other. And it's not an environment where people say, hey, you submarine me, you killed my idea. No, it's got to be an environment where people understand this because we're trying to make the right decision. I think it's really, if you create that culture, then it becomes something that permeates not only within the company, but how you interact with the customers and saying, hey, listen, my CEO is coming, doesn't want to hear that I'm a great salesperson or a great sales engineer. He really wants to, he's curious about how you use the product and what we can do better. And I think that's, if you can kind of create that introduction when you walk into a room, then that's great.
Yeah, it's such a great example. I appreciate that. I want to shift gears. I want to talk about you, which I know can be hard for humble Canadians. So when you think about how many folks would love to be CEOs of a, you know, $1.7 billion, I'm going to use the print number again, of a billion-dollar tech company, fast-growing, you know, and yet how few are able to achieve that. What do you think you've done different in your career? What's different about you?
So I think, you know, a lot of things I said around the product market fit, and being to listen with humility. I think for me in my journey, I've never assumed. First of all, I never assumed that I should be a CEO. I was asked to be a CEO, and I was like, really? So I think being very, very reflective of who you are, what you're good at, what you're not good at, what you got to learn is so important, right? And then surround yourself with people that complement that and that you can learn from. And if you know, we talked about choosing the right investor, right? It's not the right investor just because they can deliver the best valuation. I told you that's not important, but a set of investors that are going to join your board and are some of the smartest people in the room that can challenge you in a constructive way as a CEO, right? Because the board has one job, hire, fire the CEO, but can challenge you and support you, but will make you better. So critical, right? When I took over my first CEO job, I said to the investors, like with respect, none of you guys have been a CEO before. Let's find a great chairman who's been a CEO before that I can learn from, because I need to surround myself with different skill sets to learn. So it's humility, learning, and then and take your step and understand maybe there'll be a time you need to tap out. It's fine. You can get multiple shots at being a CEO. You may be the right CEO for a company for a period of time, and at some point you're not. But you should be the one that recognizes that. You shouldn't be waiting until you get the knock on your door to recognize that.
I loved what you talked about when it came to self-reflection.
Yeah.
When you think about for yourself, some things that you realize were not your strengths and some things that were your strengths, what were on those lists?
Yeah, I kind of look at, I always say to people, like, if you got your calendar open for a week and you're looking at it, everyone of us looks at the things that fill our calendar. We say there are things that are happy days and things that are not so happy days. And the good guys to the thing that you probably add value to and you enjoy the most are your happy days, right? It could be a customer meeting for me or really spending time on the product or spending time with the engineers. The things that aren't necessarily your strength and maybe your blind side, you really got to be sure that you surround yourself. So I told you how I market sushi, like that's me, right? I'm not a marketing person. So I need to surround myself with people that that are good at that, but also can work with a person that's not his natural instinct, right? I think similarly on the sales side, I love selling, but I'm not a lead, like I don't know the attributes of leading a very complex global sales organization. So again, making sure you have the right people that can complement that. Yeah, what am I good at? I think I'm very good at really helping the company align on and helping prioritize and communicate. But the part I love is the product part.
When it comes to the product part, let's dig into that. Like, what is the part that you love? What is the part where you think maybe this is, you know, you've either put in the hours or have some natural talent? Like, what aspect of the product?
I first of all, it's again goes to some of these foundationals. I like to understand how people use their product today, understand the competitive landscape, try to envision what the market should, like, what is the future of the market? What is the thing that we could do that changes everything? And then who are the competitors that are circling around here? And ideally you can take the foundation you have now, figure out something that changes the game for everybody. And ideally, you can displace a bunch of legacy or other technology or capitalize on a wave that really allows you to create value. And you can do some of that organically. You can do some of that inorganically. And I like the element of trying to find the destination and then understanding when you can reach there with your own capabilities or when you need to do it inorganically. And I think the both are really important to building a tech company. I haven't seen a tech company that fully gets to scale with it just doing everything itself. Eventually, there'll come a time where you have to do M&A, and most M&A fails. So I do enjoy that those two pieces and understand the potential of both.
Yeah. It's obvious that you think deeply and that you reflect. And that you don't take things on the surface, that you're digging and you're like probably put other people through this, but that you're willing to do it to yourself of like pushing yourself to think harder.
Yeah.
For people who want to grow that muscle in themselves, what kind of tips do you have?
Yeah. So we talked about these two key values. I told you one, open communication. The other one is velocity, which is kind of your physicist, speed plus direction. And as a scaling company growing, You should be able to move faster than any larger company. But the thing you risk is running around in circles, chasing that new thing or the latest shiny thing or chasing false positives. So I really try to emphasize on the direction part that, you know, to every complex, hard problem, there's a quick, easy, wrong answer, obvious wrong answer. So I think with your team, really try to exercise the critical thinking about, you know, the problem you're solving and asking, okay, if this is not successful, what are the 10 reasons why it won't be successful? And that's one of the questions we always ask when we're launching a new product, entering a new market, making a strategic bet, or even just looking at the upcoming year in the future. We set our priorities, we go through a budget, we go through a plan. And it's that rigor of asking what will happen, and not the external stuff like that. That's okay, great. But you can't control that. But what will happen that we can control, both that control, that would not make this successful? And getting people to think through that process, it sounds obvious, but I guarantee you, most companies don't do it. And I've sat on boards, and you asked a CEO this question, like, what won't make it successful? 9 times out of 10, you'll get all poor sales execution, or it could be a down economy. They're very light in their thinking, right? You got to be rigorous in thinking of why it won't be successful.
It makes me think of the concept that our brains will answer the questions you ask them. Like if you ask your brain, you ask, can I do this or not? There's a lot of temptation to say no. But the same situation, you say, if we had to do this, how'd we do it? All of a sudden, the brain comes up with all sorts of answers. Like a brain that would have said no comes up with all sorts of creativity.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And this idea of, like, if you don't ask, what can we, what is that is within our control are the things that would keep us from success. If the question isn't inherently asked, it may not bubble up on its own, right? Like if it isn't directly asked, it's probably not going to bubble up by accident.
Yeah, that's important. Yeah, that's a good point. And I think as a leaders in the company, you have to set that tone. That's a question that, hey, if you're going to go present to management, the CEO, you're going to get asked this question. And if you start to build that culture, then you're not building a negative culture. You're just getting a culture of rigorous thought.
Well, kind of radical self-honesty.
Radical. So you got the terms for these things. I got it written down. It's great.
I never wanted to know those answers. I was your promotional sales guy. And when I became the CEO, I was just the promotional sales guy CEO.
Yeah.
And then I got burned really, really hard and lost my entire net worth. I mean, it's such a roller coaster to put my wife through. Lost family money, lost my money. Wow. And it was painful. And like, I get it. Entrepreneur is a high contact sport. Most of the billionaires today have been through more than one bankruptcy. Luckily, I didn't have any bankruptcies, but it was darn close, right? And just, I mean, the worst thing was losing my grandpa's money. My hero in life, Jim Bridge, losing his money. I mean, like, I lost a lot more than him, but that was so, so, so painful. My hero in life, And now it's like, that sucked so bad. I am not interested in apologizing again.
Yeah.
So it curbed a lot of my natural promotion and only seeing the upside of like, just pain, just really traumatic financial pain.
I tell you, thankfully, when I take someone's money and, it could be, a large private equity, it could be an individual angel. I take it quite seriously. Like I do not want to lose. I want to be a steward of their money. And you need to take that responsibility quite seriously. And that can be your own money. It can be someone else's money, but you need to treat it just like your own money.
Well, look, I mean, we know now that NBA championships are won on defense, objectively, right? Yeah. And this concept of only offense is just extremely naive to think that they'll never, that we won't need defense, right?
Yeah.
What's one more tip for? So sometimes I get this asked question quite a bit, actually.
Yeah.
CEOs who have built into the hundreds of millions that are trying to get to the billions, or they got into the single digit billions trying to get to the double digit billions, right?
Yeah.
So let's say that we weren't recording right now, and we're on with one of these other guys, and they're saying, Steve, I'm in the hundreds of millions. How am I made to change my thinking, or what's a fundamental concept if I'm trying to get grow by an order of magnitude, kind of a generalization of crossing from the hundreds of millions into the billion plus.
Yeah, it really is the team, right? Because when you get to past 100 million, you're well beyond all that being your creativity or a few people's creativity or inspiration or drive or evangel that like selling. It's you well beyond that. And when I say team, I mean twofold. One is the team in which you operate, your executive team, the next layer down, and that quality of team, but also your investors, because investors at that stage is likely the majority of your board. That team is really important, because if you get investors that are I'll call them roller coaster investors, like back in 21, when people were being valued at 30 times sales, many investors like go hire 20 salespeople because every $1 million we generate is $20 million in valuation or $40 million in valuation. So the ROI is phenomenal, right? I don't care how much it costs to get that $1 million, right? You can, that's just some bad noise in the room and bad thinking. Similarly, when things get tough in 23, hey, we got to lay off 30% of the workforce because that's what everyone else is doing. Really want to avoid that kind of thinking. I think with your leadership team, right? You got to invest in culture. You've got to invest in the right resources that can scale, proven ability to scale, that there's a real win for them to be here, and that they can partner with the DNA of the company that's been successful to get to 100 million and really partner with those people and inspire them to and support them to get to next phase. You've got to avoid hiring people that are going to cause organ rejection. We've all seen it, right? I've got to have this new wonderful CRO or CFO. They're going to straighten things up, help me get there. And they start making bad decisions because they're not listening. They lose good people because they're not partnering with them. And it's just going to be a real train wreck. So there's one thing, it really is a team, right, at that stage.
You know, this word culture gets thrown around like crazy and means different things to different people. I would love to hear a story or an example of giving people inspiration. I like where you're going with that, but I'd love to know, like, what does that actually look like for you guys?
I'll tell you a recent example, and this was a learning I had. So we were having our sales kickoff. So it's a time that we get all the go-to-market organization together to kind of celebrate the past year, but also...
How big is the sales team and how big is the whole company?
The whole company's 400 people. At that conference, I think it was about 150 people.
Okay.
So we put a lot of effort into the presentation, the education, the motivation, and I kind of open it and I close it. And so the night before my closing, I was out talking to a bunch of the salespeople, asking them how they liked the conference. And I was with, at the time, a group of people in the company, and I'll call it younger demographic and a diverse demographic. And I was like, so what do you think of the presentations? And what I heard was, the content's really good, but there's just certain things that just aren't me. I'm like, wow, what's that? And they said, well, we use a lot of sports analogies, in the presentations, and that's just not who we are, right? And I'm like, yeah, fair point. I said, but I didn't use any sports analogies of mine. I talked about the Bee Gees for, I won't go into it, sorry, ABBA for the story, right? And she's, yeah, like, I'm like 28, I don't know who ABBA is. And I'm like, oh, okay, yeah. So I was going to close with a bunch of analogies talking about how our whole theme this year is compete, evolve, win, right? Like compete, evolve, win, right? And then, so I walked back to my room. I said, oh, what could I do that's competitive that you'd relate to? And she said, how about something like Poetry Slam? And I'm like, wow. So it's like 12 o'clock, walking back to my room, and I start to leverage every tool I can find on AI to write this very big poetry slam. And then I got on stage and I was telling about this story. And then I also said, also, I realized, maybe I'm not relating to everybody here. So I had to evolve, right? So I kind of made a joke, and I took off my jacket and my crest, like nice shirt. I had a black t-shirt underneath it. I rolled up my trousers, showed my ankles, and then I went into my poetry slam. But that wasn't the message, right? I said, like, we all have to need to compete, evolve, win, right? And I was telling you guys the same stories I told before, not different, but the same. And it wasn't resonating. So I had to take some risk. And that's who we are, right? If we can listen to our customers, like you and my customers, we can evolve. We can win. And anyways, it was I think that kind of things by a CEO helps set the culture and the tone of the company. It kind of stretches you to make your life interesting as well.
I love it. I was definitely not expecting a poetry slam. This is great. Hey, if people want to find out more about the company or connect with you, are you on LinkedIn? What are the best places?
Yeah, LinkedIn. I love LinkedIn. So yeah, if you want to connect with me, that's the easiest way. The company is, I'm steve.munford@trulio.com. So you can email me directly, but LinkedIn too. There's not a lot of Steve Munfords out there, so I'm easy to find on LinkedIn. So.
Well, I appreciate you taking so much time. This has been great.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it, Jess. Good conversation, and I think we laughed a bit too, so we confirmed.
Yeah, we're still Canadian.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks everyone. Bye.